Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silconet in Edinburgh. I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great today, David. I'm just counting down the days here in Charlottesville. I will be returning to the UK very soon, and we will be reunited.
Yes.
It feels so good. Yeah, let's move on.
Oh, no, this is where we have to be sappy and whatnot. All right, good. So this weekend in the United States is Memorial Day, a holiday that's celebrated in many ways by barbecues and sales on various things, but is a holiday to commemorate the American war dead that starts, in fact, with the American Civil War. And according to rumors that have been floated in the press, President Trump is going to mark this holiday by pardoning a handful of U.S. Service men and women who have been either accused of or convicted of war crimes. And so he's gotten some pushback from this particular trial balloon. We'll see those of you listening in the future whether he does this on Monday. But we thought this would be an opportunity to talk about the history of war crimes in the United States and how the Americans have dealt with war criminals.
Interesting thing, David, is to talk over you, but before we even dig into that, the very your introduction, in your introduction, you mentioned the fact that President Trump is considering pardoning people who've been charged with war crimes. And in a couple of cases, they haven't even been convicted yet.
Yeah.
So it's slightly odd to pardon someone before the legal process has been completed. On the other hand, I think the past week or so has demonstrated that President Trump doesn't necessarily understand legal processes in the way many of the rest of us do.
Jerry Ford pardoned Nixon before he was charged with anything.
I guess you're right. You're right. But it seems slightly odd to me to issue a preemptive pardon.
To be sure.
But anyway, but that's just a sidelight, I think, in all this. I do wonder. Sorry, David. Before we go on, do you think he's actually going to go through with it? Because this trial balloon was floated last weekend, which, of course, in Trump time feels like a decade
ago.
And so much has gone on since then, you know, with the whole bust up with Pelosi and Schumer and the tantrum or non-tantrum, depending on your perspective, in the Rose Garden. And it's very hard to know whether he'll return to this or not.
Well, he seems to I'm bad at predicting what this guy does, so I'm not going to place a wager on this, but it seems to fall in line with his general, he seems to be attracted to men who are violent and occasionally step outside prescribed rules about how to use violence. I remember him commenting about police tactics and in telling police not to be too nice.
Yeah, rough them up a little.
Not put your hand on somebody's head when you put them into a police car. And so I think it comes out of that part of his character where he has an affinity or a predilection for endorsing this kind of violence, even if it's violence that is against targeted at innocent parties. And
remember during the campaign when he talked about at his rallies since 2016, when he said, "I'll pay your legal bills if you punch protesters,"
he's endorsed waterboarding and said all these other kinds of forms of things that most people consider to be torture to be permissible, at least under his interpretation of proper conduct within wartime.
In preparation for this episode, I sacrificed myself for the good of the pod, and so I watched a little bit of Fox News coverage of this since I'm here in the U.S. And this is a kind of important talking point for Fox. Well, they don't want to talk about the president's legal difficulties, so at least some of the commentators where this particular question of pardoning these individuals is concerned have really been talking about this has been an important talking point about how you know, these are American heroes, and we're, you know, we have tied their hands behind their backs and try while they're trying to defend us. That you know, it's a very different interpretation coming from that part of the media, and that's of course the media bubble in which Donald Trump lives.
No, for sure.
In which it's sort of, you know, these guys are American heroes protecting us from dangerous terrorists, and you know, they've been misunderstood, and we're persecuting them because of these, you know, silly rules of engagement and international law.
Yeah. Now the flip side of this, of course, is that you know, the there have been several names floated about who we may or may not pardon, but they include, you know, people who shot, you know, 12-year-old girls with a sniper rifle. You know,
yeah,
and done other kinds.
I was not making that case.
But I'm just sure case, yeah. For those people who aren't familiar with the particular people in question. Yeah, they seem like they're bad actors, to put it mildly.
That's right. I mean, Edward Gallagher, the Navy SEAL who was turned in by his fellow SEALs, is the one who seems to have shot a number of civilians, including children. You know, and he's a bad actor, it seems, based on the evidence I've. But anyway, let's historicize this
okay.
stuff.
Okay, so let's go back to your period, Frank. Did they have a conception of war crimes in the American Revolution?
Yes. I mean, you know, just war theory, of course, goes back to ancient times, and there's a long tradition of it in church law, in fact, in terms of the origins of, you know, with the origins of Christianity. So there was a notion that some types of war fighting were acceptable, and methods of fighting war were acceptable, and others were unacceptable. And during the Revolution, for example, as listeners may know, you certainly know, I'm writing this book about Thomas Jefferson's relationship with George Washington. And there's a very interesting kind of moment in that relationship when Jefferson was governor of Virginia and Washington was commander in the Continental Army. And it concerned a man named Henry Hamilton. And Henry Hamilton was the British commander at Detroit. Hamilton had encouraged native peoples in the Northwest, according to Jefferson, to attack settlers. And while Hamilton is governor of Detroit and Jefferson was serving as governor of Virginia, Virginia troops captured Henry Hamilton and brought him to Williamsburg. And Jefferson wanted him held in chains in a dungeon because he had encouraged Native Americans to kill civilians and to kill Virginia civilians. And as far as he was concerned, he didn't use the phrase war crimes, but these were war crimes and he should be punished accordingly. He shouldn't be accorded the usual privileges that would be extended to a captured enemy officer. And Washington writes to him, to Jefferson, that is. And Washington, of course, has his own experience with Indian warfare, and that's a complicated story in and of itself. But Washington writes to him and says, basically, please don't do this. You can't do this. And Washington's argument was, look, the British have far more of our officers than we have of theirs. If you make an example of Henry Hamilton, it's going to make things much worse for our men who are being – our officers who are being held as prisoners by the British. And it's just going to make my life much more difficult. Please don't do this. And they have a kind of very interesting – exchange of views over this, and I offer this in answer to your question to say, I mean, it's a vignette, it's a small thing in the grand scheme of things, but there are questions during the War of Independence, and they often are associated with how you treat both combatants and non-combatants. And unsurprisingly for listeners of this podcast, race is often a key factor there. So warfare is conducted differently between and among Europeans and people of European descent than it is when Europeans and people of European descent encounter either indigenous peoples or enslaved peoples in war. And so the some of the worst crimes that are committed, what we would term war crimes during the American War of Independence, are either perpetrated by or against Native peoples, and so it's often involving, you know, the race is often the key factor then, but there are certainly incidents and in some cases entire campaigns that we could construe in using the kind of language of the 20th century as war crimes. There's no doubt about that. Where I think you have war crimes wherever you have war, and the reason there are rules of war is because there's an assumption that people, you have to draw the line. It's about what happens at the margins. And I don't say the margins because this is unimportant behavior, quite the contrary, but it's about people who transgress and where the line is. And the line is very blurry in the American Revolution, in part for this racial, because of the racial dynamic, as I've already alluded to. But as you well know, it's also a civil war, and civil wars often bring out the worst in people.
Well, what strikes me about your description there is in the 18th century, there are ideas that wars have rules to them. That seems to be a fairly common Western idea by the end of the 18th century. But they're very much unwritten rules, that the precise boundaries about what is permissible in war and what is not permissible in war is much more open to interpretation than obviously will become later.
Well, I'd actually push back slightly about that. I mean, I think you're right. I think the rules become more refined later, and you're going to talk about this, I know. But I think, you do have international law emerging, really, in the aftermath of the 30 Years' War in continental Europe. But, you've got thinkers like Grotius and Pufendorf, these important continental international lawyers who are starting to lay down in the 17th century, 16th and 17th centuries, the rules of international law, and there's a recognition that there needs to be a set of rules. Now, again, one has rules in part because one needs rules because people are transgressing them, but it's not just custom by the 18th century. I think there are things that have been kind of put down, and treaty law is very much premised on international treaties are premised on the assumption that there is some sort of international order, and warfare is part of that, I think.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's interesting, though, about this particular moment and thinking about the example you gave is you're discussing an example where the United States, or the proto-United States, or call it whatever you want to at this point, is holding to account an enemy combatant for war crimes. And most, I think, the examples we're going to be talking about later in the episode are about Americans holding other Americans accountable for war crimes. It's much easier to hold an enemy accountable for war crimes than it is to do so for your own people.
Yes, I mean, one of the worst war crimes, I think we can use that phrase, during the American Revolution occurs in Ohio in 1782, when a church full of peaceful Native Americans is the church is set alight by Patriot militia, and dozens or 100 Native Americans are burned to death as a result, and they were nonviolent civilians. They were civilian noncombatants. In fact, they were praying. They were pacifists. They were Moravian Indians, Indians who become Moravians. And so that at Gnadenhütten in Ohio. As far as I know, nobody was convicted for that.
Yeah, and I think the same is true for most wars against Native peoples throughout the colonial period and throughout the 19th century, is you do have what, on our modern framing would be considered war crimes, in as much as you're executing captives, attacking civilians, what have you. But they're not framed in the language of war crimes, by the participants, or at least by the white participants, because of the ways in which both race and military power were conceived of at the time.
Yeah, and I think we have to talk about the legal aspects of this, I realize, but I think that there's a kind of unbroken line that's really important there, because the army that did the U.S. Army in the 19th century that will be responsible for many of those crimes against Native Americans in North America will, at the end of the 19th century, turn of the 20th century, be sent to the Philippines to deal with the Philippine insurrection in the aftermath of the Spanish-American War, and will engage in pretty extensive war crimes then. But the Philippines are almost seen as an extension of the American West in that context, and the Army's actions are treated as, it's seen as those actions are seen more or less as being akin to what happened where the Army's battles against Native Americans or injustices against Native Americans of a generation or two before. And so there's a kind of unbroken line there, and that leads the history of U.S. war crimes is far more pronounced against Native peoples in North America and then against non-whites in Asia, in East Asia and Southeast Asia, than it is, for example, when fighting either Europeans or in Europe, I think. Although war crimes will happen in those contexts too.
To be sure. You know, thinking about sort of the legal codification of this, I mean, there's a couple points that I think are pretty significant. One is the Liber Code, which is put in place during the Civil War, which is a legal treatise written by Francis Lieber, who was a immigrant legal scholar that was authorized by the Lincoln administration to really codify a set of laws of war about how you treat prisoners, how you deal with guerrillas, you know, what are the sort of bounds of when is violence permissible in warfare, on against whom is violence permissible, and when does legal violence under the guise of military action, when is that different from extra legal violence that's, you know, murder and what have you. And this, I think, is really one of the first efforts to take these kinds of legal principles that legal theorists and international lawyers have been writing about in the you know, 18th century, take those and actually put those into policy, because these become General Orders 100 that's sort of disseminated throughout the Union Army. And this, you know, creates a sort of a legal framework for saying, okay, here's what's the rules of war are, and here's what's beyond them. And here's, you know, potentially punishment for violating them. And this becomes in some ways the basis for later structures of thinking about war crimes. You know, the later Hague Conventions draw upon the Liber Code. The Geneva Conventions just come after that, also sort of draw upon the Liber Code as a foundational work for how you think about international law. And what the laws of war are and what a war crime might be. There aren't that many people, though, who are prosecuted for war crimes in the American Civil War. There are definitely lots of what we would consider war crimes. We can think of like the Fort Pillow Massacre, for instance, as a war crime. But there are relatively few prosecutions at the end of the Civil War. Probably the most famous is Henry Wirtz, who was the commandant of the Andersonville prison, who was executed in November of 1865 because he was running this prison in which 13,000 men died. But there are relatively few other prosecutions for war crimes during the Civil War. It's not really until later that you start to see active prosecutions of American service people for their actions in wartime.
So what do you think explains that? Because on one hand, the Civil War was, of, among other things, as you know better than me, a massive insurrection.
Yeah.
And civil wars can lead to particularly heinous behavior, and often vindictive kind of vindictive peace settlements. So why were there so few? Was it because the concept was still kind of relatively inchoate in the 19th century, or is there something else at work?
Well, so there's a discussion that's happening during the final months of the war about what they're going to do with Confederate leadership. You know, and there are some people who are arguing maybe we should prosecute all the Confederate leaders for treason and then have, you know, trials for, especially people like, you know, Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was instrumental in the Fort Pillow Massacre, and then various other people. And the feeling was that if that was, there were a couple of rationales for not going down that road. One is if Confederates thought they were all going to be prosecuted for treason, or their leadership class thought they'd be prosecuted for treason, then potentially executed, that would make the war drag out that much longer. You're not going to lay down your arms if you think that the next step is going to be a treason conviction,
right?
You know, and the other reason, was that the thought was that this is a civil war in which you want to eventually have the people who are your enemies become your countrymen again. And making that reconciliation happen as quickly as possible was in the national best interest. So, you know, there was the decision to, you know, when you issue the paroles for Confederate soldiers and officers, you know, in 1865, they do say that you're not going to be harassed by the federal government unless you take up arms again, which gave some level of protection to Confederates who had engaged in war crimes. And I think they recognized that. There were people who knew that they had done things that would potentially get them in legal jeopardy after the war, but then they sort of saw those paroles as a way of securing their you know, immunity from that kind of prosecution. One can envision, obviously, an alternative end to the Civil War where that doesn't happen, but you know, they're clearly working through the ideas about what the best way to sort of use war crimes and war crime prosecution as a means of you know, creating justice and other things. You know, thinking forward though about, you know, after the Civil War, one of the places in which the Labor Code is actually used for prosecuting somebody is during the Philippine American War, in the aftermath of the Spanish American War. There are American servicemen who are prosecuted for war crimes there, probably not as many as should have been, given the kind of carnage that happened during that insurrection war, call it whatever framing you want. You know, I think for those of you who aren't familiar with this episode in American history, the Spanish-American War in 1898, the United States defeats Spain, takes over some former Spanish territories, including Puerto Rico and the Philippines. The Filipinos, who had been fighting a war of independence against Spain, originally assumed that Americans were coming to liberate them and were unhappy when the United States annexed the Philippines, to put it mildly. And led by Emilio Aguinaldo, they fight a war against American occupation, which Americans... in which the American military ends up crushing very brutally. And a handful of American military officers, most notably General Jacob Smith, get prosecuted for engaging in war crimes against Filipino civilians. Smith ordered his men to basically kill all Filipino men capable of bearing arms. When soldiers asked him, well, how old is a man that's capable of bearing arms? He said everyone over the age of 10. And we don't know exactly how many people died as a consequence of Smith's orders, but some people have posted in the tens of thousands under that particular episode alone. And Smith is court-martialed, and I think he's basically just forced to retire, though, in terms of, rather than being actively punished for, I guess, beyond forced retirement. So there is some conception there of both war crimes and that the role of the federal government is to police its own soldiers about their conduct in war and to ensure that they're not violating the rules that they had set down.
Yes, but the kind of contemporary framework we live with is really a product of the 20th century, isn't it? With first the creation of the League of Nations, and then after the Second World War, the United Nations, there's a belief that, as I said, it kind of is the fulfillment of those first ideas promulgated back in the 16th and 17th centuries, that there is an international order and that there is a kind of common community of nations that needs to kind of adhere to certain rules. And so we get in the 20th century, it's ironic because the 20th century obviously gives the world the bloodiest wars it's ever had to date, but also a sense that there's a there ought to be international law, and there are bounds and there are things which should not be there are boundaries that shouldn't be transgressed.
I mean, that's definitely the United States buys into that, I think, a lot when they are talking about prosecuting Nazis. You know, if you think about like the Nuremberg trials and what have you, the United States is a supporter of upholding the rules of war when it comes to prosecuting the enemies of the United States. I think they're less on board, though, with it when it comes to prosecuting American soldiers for engaging in really heinous activities.
Yeah, and I think there's a cynical kind of interpretation of this, which is not without merit, which is more or less, you know, the United States is a great power, is basically saying, well, these rules apply to you, they don't apply to us. Hmm. But I think there's something more at work there than simply the kind of great power abusing that power. So if one looks at the failure of the United States to ratify the treaty that, you know, the Versailles Treaty with the League of Nations that created the League of Nations, or one, you know, you can draw a line from that to the refusal of the United States to participate in or sanction the current International Criminal Court in The Hague. You know, the United States has said quite explicitly, our soldiers will never be tried. We are not a signatory to this. Our soldiers and sailors and air personnel will never, ever be taken to The Hague and tried for war crimes. That's not because the United States doesn't believe in war crimes. I think it's, on one hand, the United States, at least until recently, Americans would have said, well, yeah, the rule of law is inherent in being American. It's central to our system, and we have laws to deal with this. We have both military laws to deal with this, and we have civilian laws to deal with this, or civil laws to deal with this as appropriately. And, you know, we can police ourselves. And there's also a sort of exceptionalist premise to a lot of this, which is the United States is somehow different. Yeah. And you know, we stand for freedom. We fight for freedom. We don't fight for, you know, self-aggrandizement and so on and so forth. And therefore, you know, we will hold ourselves to a higher standard or different standard, but we will not be held to a standard by non-Americans. And I'm summarizing this view. I am not endorsing this view. I want to make this clear. But I think that it's not just kind of it's not as simple as sort of American arrogance, although there's part of that, or sort of a great power throwing its weight around in the American reluctance to do this. I think there's an American this behavior is premised on an assumption that the United States is exceptional and different, and that although there are war crimes and these must be enforced, or there's some conception of war crimes, we'll deal with this ourselves, is the kind of premise of it.
I mean, the question then that begs is, can a country police its own war crimes effectively? Right? And I think part of the premise of the International Criminal Court is that these are crimes against humanity, and therefore the proper adjudication requires the premise, I guess, of any criminal proceedings in some ways is you need to be judged, or at least the jury needs to be an impartial jury, and that one cannot effectively try one's own countrymen in this particular context. And the question, you know, as these international frameworks have built up over the course of the 20th century and into the 21st century, the United States has sort of endorsed it for other people, but stepped aside when it came to policing its own actions. And we can think about sort of like in Vietnam, how well did the United States do in policing the actions of its own men? How well does the uniform code of military justice, how well does that cope with really heinous activity, of which there's multiple documented examples?
Yeah, well, I think, I've got two responses to that. I think on one hand, the answer is pretty obvious. It doesn't do a very good job of it. And Vietnam's a good example. So in the aftermath of the My Lai massacre in 1968, you know, I think it was 26 men were charged in that incident, it was the murder of more than 500 Vietnamese by American military personnel. only one was convicted, Lieutenant Calley, of course, but he only served, you know, 3.5 years of more or less house arrest before he was paroled. So it's a bit like the example of Smith from the Philippine insurrection of almost, you know, half a century earlier, or more than half a century earlier, you know, where even where there was a conviction, there wasn't really, one can argue it doesn't seem that justice was done. So that would seem to suggest the answer to your question, David, is that, you know, Americans can't do this. On the other hand, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, you know, the code's not the problem. It's the enforcement of the code.
Okay.
So it seems to me that you know, it's not that these things are not against American law or U.S. law, either civil or military. It's about the enforcement of it. It seems to me that's the problem. And that would make me, and I think along the tone of your question, sympathetic to the ICC, the International Criminal Court. On the other hand, one of the arguments that American critics of the ICC make is Americans won't get justice there because there's so much resentment of the United States around the world, and that if an American soldier is brought before the ICC, they will not get a fair hearing. And that argument is not without merit. I mean, I think if for international organizations to work, you have to have buy-in from the international community, and that includes the United States. So the answer is not to ignore it, and the answer is to work with it, and so on. But and to ensure that, you know, provide your citizens with appropriate representation and things like that. But the criticism of the court, especially among many conservatives in the United States, is that Americans would never get justice there, and that being so, we will have to handle these things ourselves. And that would be a more compelling argument to me. I think it's not without merit if there was a record of the United States actually policing itself in a more comprehensive way.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at, I think your point about the difference between what the, you know, Uniform Code of Military Justice says and the way it's implemented. I mean, I believe with Lieutenant Calley in the Vietnam example, I think he was originally sentenced to life in prison, but then that was reduced to 10 years and then it was commuted to 3 years of house arrest. You know, had he been given a life sentence, you know, the moral argument the United States could police itself would have probably held a little bit more weight, you know. And I think one of the criticisms that many military leaders have launched against President Trump in the past week, since this idea has been floated, of pardoning a number.
And there's been a lot of criticism from the military.
It is that, you know, the reputation of the United States military would be fundamentally damaged if we pardon people, you know, who have been either convicted or look like they're about to be convicted of really serious crimes, and that it will actually put American service people in jeopardy. You know, that part of the reason why you uphold these rules of warfare is to, you know, set a floor not only for yourself but also for your enemy, and that when you you know, fail to live up to your own standards, it actually creates you know, incentive for other powers to say, well, if you're not willing to uphold the rules, then we don't have to either, whether that's about torture or chemical warfare or what have you. So I think it really does, you know, it undermines sort of military discipline. It undermines the whole, like, conception that you know, these are, the military is engaging in legal violence because it has the sanction of you know, the nation state, and it's abiding by certain rules. Otherwise, it's just murder.
That's right. And you know, having looked in the right wing and conservative coverage of this story over the past few days in anticipation of this podcast, one of the things that becomes clear is it seems to be an article of faith on the right, at least, or in right wing media, that the rules of engagement somehow limit American soldiers when they're fighting, and somehow Americans are somehow are disadvantaged because the rules of engagement under which they fight somehow limit their ability to defend themselves and consequently to defend us. Now, again, the story of Edward Gallagher, the SEAL who's been accused, is pretty appalling, you know, where he seems to be just deliberately shooting civilians, you know, with his sniper rifle, and so much, and they couldn't get him to stop.
So that's not a rule of engagement problem.
But the way it's been spun is that the rules of engagement, you know, and this goes back to at least 50 years with Vietnam and the aftermath of Vietnam, the kind of right-wing talking point that the Americans would have won if they hadn't had to fight with one hand tied behind their back. I mean, it's a nonsense, but it's quite prominent in some of the commentary, and at least on the part of those people who are defending President Trump's possible action. I think President Trump probably believes that based on some of the things he's said and his, you know, and you began with the, you know, observing that he likes these sort of supposed tough guys, people who appear to be tough guys who are willing to either break the rules or, you know, at least go up to the line in, you know, to get what needs to be done, or do what needs to be done. I think that view is perhaps more popular. I think that's a factor in this debate that we need to consider. I think it's probably more popular outside the military than inside the military. It's probably limited to a certain segment of the population, but I think it's a powerful thing. I mean, in the aftermath of the My Lai massacre, 75% of the American public supported the soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
This was at a time when the war was unpopular.
Right after the Tet Offensive, right?
This is an important factor. So the problem might not be international law. The problem might not be the military. The problem might be us in the sense, you know, the body politic.
Well, I mean, one of the things I think that's happened since 9/11, you know, and as the kind of the nature of the threat has changed, you know. And I blame television, you know, a very slight bit for this. You know, the idea that, you know, there are terrorists out there that we need to, you know, who are on the verge of attacking the United States and having another 9/11, and you know, we need to use whatever methods we have to get the information out of them, even if it means stepping over some lines to do so, you know, is a very dangerous idea, because I think, you know, there's a slippery slope you can get into there. There's the sort of idea of a ticking bomb somewhere, and the terrorist has information about where the bomb is located. That sort of scenario has been very prevalent in American popular culture over the past, you know, 20 years.
24, Homeland. Yes, I mean, and the number of TV series that have that. Some version of that story as a premise is well, more than we can count.
Yes, it's a lot. And I think that is, in some ways, I don't know whether the people who are making these shows were doing this with malice or this intent, but the supposition there is that, you know, the heroes of those shows, the guys who break the rules, who look at international law and look at the sort of standards of how you're supposed to treat prisoners and whatnot, and say this is a different case, this is a different situation because of this imminent threat, and therefore the rules go out the window. I think that feeds a certain kind of disregard for these standards, and heroicizes those people who do step outside of them.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I've observed, I mean, I've noted this since 9/11, but certainly in my year here, which is really remarkable, for at least it's a change from when I was a kid, is the degree to which the military has been fetishized in the United States and is now beyond criticism. And so on one hand, this was a backlash against the so-called Vietnam syndrome, I think. And I think that Vietnam syndrome and the alleged disrespect for the military in the aftermath of the Vietnam War has been overblown. But that is a kind of prominent trope. And after 9/11 in particular, with the surge in patriotism and the rise of a really powerful security state, you know, we've seen the militarization of American life in bizarre ways. And let me kind of develop this idea. On one hand, very few people serve. I think it's 1% of the population. And we ask those who serve to serve repeatedly. And so very few people are being asked to make sacrifices, yet those who serve are serving repeatedly. So those who are serving are kind of bearing a disproportionate burden. Yet the culture at large has just fetishized the military in a way that wasn't true, as I say, 40 years ago. So, for example, you know, this week is Memorial Day. This weekend is Memorial Day. Memorial Day, as you say, goes back to the aftermath of the Civil War. In November, we have Veterans Day, which is a product which began in the aftermath of the First World War, and is a kind of, you know, November 11th. It's kind of, at least across the West, is a day to commemorate military service. So we have two holidays. Last weekend, you may not know this, was Armed Forces Day.
What's the proper way to celebrate Armed Forces Day?
Well, I don't know. Armed Forces Day was created by Harry Truman in the aftermath of the Second World War, and it's to thank the troops for their service. So all these things have existed for a while, but they've been amped up. And the reason I know it was Armed Forces Day is I happened to be watching a baseball game on television, and the players were wearing camouflage hats. So they were wearing sort of military-themed uniforms, and the commentator said, well, and of course it's Armed Forces Day. And I thought, well, Veterans Day's next week, are you kidding me? And we talked a little bit about this with when we talked about the controversy over playing the national anthem before NFL games in a previous episode. But these kind of public observances, or, you know, if you fly now, uniformed military personnel get on the plane first. Again, I'm not saying that's not a good idea. I'm just saying these are all of a piece. I went to a National Hockey League game a couple of months ago down in North Carolina. I went to see the Carolina Hurricanes in Raleigh. And before the game, they've got the two Zambonis, you know, the machines that clean the ice before the game. And sitting next to the guys, you know, cleaning the ice on both Zambonis were Marines in their uniforms waving to the crowd. And then during the game, we stopped and acknowledged people for their military service. I went to a Boston Red Sox game a few years ago with my family, and I was sitting with my brother, and it happened to be Memorial Day weekend. So again, the players were all in camouflage uniforms instead of their regular uniforms, and they kept stopping between innings to do this and do that. And again, I'm not necessarily against this, except that, well, as my brother looked at me, we're standing there, and I said, this is a little over the top, isn't it? He said, well, you got to support the troops. He said that sort of sarcastically, but it's true. It's become a truism. You can't say this is a ridiculous thing. But the militarization and the celebration of all things military in American life has really amped up in the past 20 years in ways that I think are not necessarily healthy for democracy. And I think it's a manifestation, that cultural phenomena has laid the groundwork for the kind of attitudes we see from President Trump and on Fox News when it comes to, you know, saying, well, we need to pardon these guys because they fight for our freedom.
I mean, you saw similar things to that in, you know, like during the Second World War, but then it quickly evaporated when the war ended.
People went home.
And there was obviously, as you point out, a very different demographic to who was fighting. I mean, one of the things I'm also just sort of following up on that I've noticed thinking about this historically, since 9/11, the United States has actually done a better job, and it hasn't done a good job, but a better job than it has in previous conflicts in holding its soldiers accountable for war crimes. So we can think about, Abu Ghraib, where they, you know, there were 11 people convicted of war crimes for their conduct holding Iraqi prisoners, and there have been other cases in which the United States military has prosecuted its own soldiers for actions taken in both Iraq and Afghanistan and other theaters of conflict. Now they're often not punishing them very severely, but they are taking seriously, relatively speaking, this obligation to hold people accountable. And I think part of the reason for that is that we are in a, you know, media age in which, you know, images of Iraqi prisoners being abused, you know, serves a real recruiting tool for enemies of the United States, and prosecuting those who conduct, you know, engage in that conduct as a, you know, way of combating that, if you will.
Had those photos from Abu Ghraib not come out, undoubtedly that not, you know, there would have been no convictions. But once those photos came out and went around the world, action had to be taken.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's other episodes of both torture and violence the United States has been involved with in Iraq and Afghanistan, in Haditha and Kandahar and other places. The number of prosecutions is up, although the number of meaningful convictions is still, like in the Vietnam and the My Lai example. You know, they charge a number of people. Usually very few people end up getting convicted, and those that do don't receive significant punishment, at least not heretofore.
Well, this is a rather
downer.
It's a depressing topic, to be sure.
The thing about Trump's pardons or potential pardons is, you know, of course, in order to pardon somebody or potential, or, you know, they either have to be charged or are about to be charged for something. You know, if you are fighting a conflict in which you are not prosecuting people for war crimes, you don't need to pardon them. So I think that part of what's interesting about this particular moment is that we are, in some ways, the military is trying to hold people accountable, and that's being undermined by the president.
Yes, I mean, well, I would say two things. One, in relation to us. Normally, I'm the optimist in this group, and you're the pessimist, but you seem to be on a slightly more optimistic note than me, so we should acknowledge that. The other thing is that you're right. A pardon is premised on the guilt of the person being pardoned. Now, I'm not sure Donald Trump is thinking in those terms, because he just thinks the pardon power is a great little benefit of being president. But a pardon, by definition, acknowledges the guilt of the individual receiving the pardon. It's not exoneration. And you're right. There is there have been more convictions recently than we've seen in other conflicts. And maybe that's because we've been in perpetual conflict, so there are more incidents now since 9/11. But it also may reflect a change in the culture, and this might be another case where the culture is changing for the better, but President Trump represents a sort of atavistic reaction against that, we'll see how that plays out.
Definitely. All right.
I still wonder whether he'll do it, only insofar as so much has happened in the past few days, and, you know, he does seem to have trouble focusing. On the other hand, he is desperate to appease his base, and this is something that seems to be important to them, and I think to him, so maybe he will do it. If he does, it'll be yet another, you know, terrible action perpetuated by President Trump. Tune in next week to see what's next.
Exactly. Listeners in the future, you can see how correct we were with our forecasting. Right, time for last drops, Frank. What you got?
I want to just endorse a book by, in fact, they're by my friends, Nancy Eisenberg and Andy Burstein. Nancy and Andy have written a book together called The Problem of Democracy. And it's about, the subtitle is The President's Atoms Confront the Cult of Personality. And Nancy and Andy, who teach at Louisiana State University, are very, very good historians and fine historians and fine people. And they've written this book together. And what's interesting is it's about the presidencies and the relationship between John Adams and his son John Quincy Adams, but it's not a conventional political narrative. It's not a conventional narrative in any way. It's a really well-written book. It's a beautiful book. But it's looking at what they have to say as they confronted what they see as the problem of democracy, as the title of the book is, and then the limits of democracy and the role of the cult of personality in American politics, which they saw as a baneful influence. And it obviously has contemporary resonances. They looked at the rise of somebody like Andrew Jackson and kind of, you know, shook their heads and thought this was a terrible example of some of the consequences of the political system created by the revolution. But at the same time, they argue that the Adamses are slightly grumpy, but they're also really, really – they really do believe in democracy and that we've misread them. It's a really fascinating book and worth reading. I think it's interesting because it's it's a book written by two people who've collaborated together, and I think that's an interesting approach. But so I'm reading it right now. It's beautifully written. It couldn't be more timely. It's got obvious resonance for contemporary matters, and so I would give it two thumbs up on Frank's Book Club. So yeah, really, really good.
All right, good.
What about you, David? What's your last?
So longtime listeners to the podcast will remember that many months ago, I used as a last drop a news story that they had found the slave ship Clotilda, which was one of the last slave vessels to import slaves illegally into the United States in 1860. There was a story months ago in which somebody said they had found this ship. There was a big to-do about that. And then I had to retract that last drop because turns out that was not the Clotilda. Well, turns out now that in the aftermath of that, people have been actively trying to find the ruined wreckage of this ship, and an archaeological team associated with the Alabama Historical Commission thinks they have now found the Clotilda, or the what's left of it. The ship was, I believe, burned when and after it landed in Alabama. So we now, I guess this is sort of the third part of my last drop from months ago. They now have what we think is the Clotilda until, of course, this gets retracted in a few weeks. We'll see. I'm hoping it is because it's a very important, story. It's a very, it's obviously the ship that comes in right before the Civil War. There's a really important book that was just published that's the narrative of somebody who was on this ship, who had been interviewed by Zora Neale Hurston. I'm glad to have a closure with this story, at least for the time being.
Excellent. Right. Okay.
Until next time, Frank.
Well, cheers. Enjoy Memorial Day, David.
Oh, yes. Bye. Well, bye.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.